Welcome to the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Here are your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub.
Welcome to Legally Sound Smart Business. This is Nasser Pasha.
And this is Matt Staub.
This is where we talk about business in the news and also answer your business legal questions. And we take care of all your business legal needs. So let's take it away, Matt.
The first story that we have this week is a story about Google, and it looks like they just won a dismissal in a case. So if anyone's ever searched something on Google before and it's directed to a book or any sort of article like that, this is essentially what this case was about. It's a judge accepted Google's argument that the scanning of, I think here, more than 20 million books constituted fair use under the U.S. copyright law. And this is something that I've noticed before for years now. Like I said, I've Googled things before and these books have popped up and I just wondered how they got away with it. But now that it's gone through this case, it makes more sense.
Yeah, I think at first they were actually in the very beginning when they were scanning books. I think everyone thought that Google Books would be like our online library because no one goes to libraries anymore, but pretty much they have almost every single book that's been published. And you can get it for free there, but the difference is you have to actually drive to the library and check out a book, whereas on Google Books, you can just look online. But it looks like they didn't actually publish the entire books. Their snippets are shown, right?
Right, and that's what I've run into before as well. I'll Google something, it'll pull up this book, and it'll just be, you know, maybe one chapter or two chapters of whatever book it is. Another thing that I've always found interesting with this is you can actually search within the book. That's how stuff has popped up for me before. I've searched a certain word or a certain phrase, and you can actually go to this Google document or this Google book or whatever it is, and you can search this phrase and you can find it just like you would on a find on a normal web page, which is pretty crazy. It always just looked like a book, the fact that you could search it like a web page or a PDF or a Word document. I always thought it was pretty crazy. I don't know.
So they're using this concept of fair use. And I think as business owners, we always, when we're writing content online or what have you, we're always wondering what's our fine line as to how much we can copy and not, even with attributing the author's name to it. And it looks like they're finding a fine line because I think you're right. When you do a search, it pretty much searches the whole book, but they're taking steps to only show parts of it. So the court this time agreed to them. The Authors Guild is the one that's suing them. They're going to appeal. We'll see where this goes. But I wonder, I think the authors could benefit from this in the sense that if you find a book that has the search terms that you're looking for, and I think they have this even, and there's a link to buy that book online, then I'm more likely to buy that book, just like I'm browsing on in a library.
That makes sense. I'm also wondering how this would have been decided if it was a whole book that had been scanned in and not just one chapter or two chapters. I don't know if that would have changed the decision that was brought down.
Oh, I think so, definitely. Well, let's put our legal twist on this. What is fair use, right? There's about four factors that copyright law has given exception to allow fair use, meaning you can use someone else's copyrighted works without their permission. And one of those factors is the amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyrighted material. So for example, on this podcast, we can play a 5-second snippet of a song, but if the entire song is only 1 minute long or 30 seconds long, then maybe 5 seconds or 20 seconds is too much. And so here, if it's just a few pages from a book, that's going to make a big difference than a whole chapter.
So what if I sing Miley Cyrus songs during the podcast? If I sing the whole thing, then I think that's fine, right? I might do that later in the episode.
We would get complaints from not only Miley Cyrus, but also probably most our listeners from your singing, but you're welcome to. We can try it out.
All right. We'll see if we get any requests and then maybe next episode.
Okay. That sounds good.
All right. I'll get into the first question here. This is from, it says, a typical office here in Fresno, California. How accommodating do I have to be for special requests made by employees? Some have to come in later, some have to come in earlier, some require more breaks than mandated. Help. And that's it.
Well, we're going to try to help you, and we can help other listeners if you send in your question at ask@legallysoundsmartbusiness.com, and we'll try to answer your business legal question. So this person works in a typical office. I can sympathize with that. And so he says, how accommodating do I have to be for special requests? Well, what do you think they mean by special requests?
They gave a couple examples. Someone coming in earlier, someone coming in later. I could see, you know, someone with a child or kids I have to drop off at school. That's not too big of a special request. Someone needing more breaks than what's required by law. Again, it's not a huge difference, but if they're taking a ton of breaks every day, that would change things a little bit.
Yeah, maybe smoke breaks or something. I think it matters what the reason for the breaks are, because generally you have control of your employees. And at will employment, you can pretty much have them do whatever you want within the bounds of the law. Right. So I assume if they're asking this question, it's probably because of maybe some kind of underlying disability that's causing these special requests.
A disability would make a lot more sense in what an employer would deem a special request. I would think that would be pretty frequent with a lot of businesses. Just at some point, they have someone with a disability and they need to accommodate whatever special things they need in there for them to do their job correctly.
Very good. So when it comes to special requests regarding disability, it's pretty straightforward. If you have more than 25 employees, or if you're in California, which I think a lot of our listeners are, it's five or more. Of course, California is always a little bit more restrictive. You have to go through this disability accommodation process. And it's a very difficult process. And even me attempting to explain how to do it over this podcast is a little risky because you can easily get misguided. But here's generally how you do it, okay? And take this with a grain of salt because there's a lot more to it and a lot more variables. But you have to first determine what are the limitations that the disability is causing to that person's job performance. Now, keep in mind, this is not an inquiry to determine what kind of disability they have, because that's risky in itself. This is to determine what their limitations are. And then after you find what their limitations are, then you have to find out, okay, what can we do to mitigate these limitations so that he or she can still maintain or perform their job duties? Then it becomes an issue of, okay, well, are these mitigations, whether it's giving them more breaks or giving them a special chair or et cetera, are they such that it's going to get in the way of the essential job function? Or would those accommodations produce so much undue hardship on the employer that it's not reasonable for them to undertake that? And so they'd have to go through that process. So if we have somebody that is asking for another break because they need to stretch their back every hour or so, more than what the minimum for breaks is, would that be a reasonable accommodation?
I think that's reasonable. It's not going to take up too much time to do that. And they're not asking for very much either.
Yeah. How long does it take to stretch? But what if it was something like, okay, I need to do a exercise that requires an hour's worth of time every hour. So basically every hour they're taking a break for an hour, something to that effect.
Yeah.
That may not be reasonable.
A lot different, right? This sounds like another case-by-case analysis, and you look at the specific request and the reason behind it, and they can then get into the great advice that you've given.
Thank you very much. Well, most of the time, I think employers get into trouble because they don't enter into this process in the first place. A lot of times, if you make good faith efforts to work with your employee, like we had an instance where someone had back problems, and all they needed was a desk that was, they got uncomfortable if they sat for a long time. We just got them a desk that was adjustable so they can convert it to a standing desk when they need to. And it was a little bit extra cost, but it wasn't that big of a deal to get, and it solved the problem.
Right.
Well, thanks for the question. Typical office person from Fresno, California. Keep them coming.
All right. We'll get into the next article here. And this one has to do with Yelp. And we're going to try not to spend too much time talking about Yelp because I know we could fill an entire podcast episode. But this is a really interesting lawsuit that occurred. It's Yelp users are suing Yelp because they're saying that essentially that they're employees for writing these reviews. I guess these are all top reviewers. One person in particular has 1,100 reviews. I don't think I've ever even been to 1,100 places in my entire lifetime, nor would I ever want to write about them. This is a really interesting case. Did you get a chance to look at this lawsuit?
Yeah, I think this is... I looked over even the complaint too, because frankly, this is just clever lawyering. Not to give these guys too much credit, but they're trying to take advantage of some loose definitions of what a volunteer is. And the Fair Labor and Employment Administration, they have enacted certain definitions of what a volunteer is. And they've made those pretty specific to protect other individuals that employers try to take advantage by classifying them as volunteers. A good example is in the film industry. A lot of actors, employers try to consider them volunteers so that they don't have to pay them because, you know, it's a very tough industry and a lot of these filmmakers don't have the budget. But the Fair Labor Standard Act has actually classified these types of, quote, volunteers as employees. So here, these attorneys are using that same kind of concept. These people are spending their time reviewing these restaurants and they're encouraging them to do so. And now they're owed minimum wage. And that's their legal theory.
I think you're exactly right with the clever lawyering, looking through some of the ways they phrased this. One user was, quote unquote, fired because they could no longer leave reviews. And they're missing out on the award and public recognition involved in writing these reviews. I would be really upset if I could no longer be a duke or duchess, or at the lower end, baron or baroness. It's just kind of crazy. I can't see this working out.
Imagine if Yelp lost this lawsuit, how bad this would be. Now, every time I put a review upon anything, Amazon or not, then I expect to get paid for that. It doesn't make any sense. And you know, there's no expectation for the reviewer to get paid for this. So how they consider themselves employee, I think they're stretching. And you know, the reality is this one plaintiff that wrote 1,100 reviews, again, how they got to that number, they pretty much devoted their life to Yelp and reviewing, and they obviously don't have a regular job. So therefore, they needed to be compensated somehow. So it was a last resort to settle with this lawsuit.
I think the most underrated thing about this is we're actually siding with Yelp in this situation, which I didn't think I would ever do, but...
Oh, gosh. That's a great point. And you're right that we could cover a lot of legal issues surrounding Yelp. I know a lot of our clients and other business owners have a lot of frustration with how Yelp reviews work and their practices of advertising and their manipulation of good reviews and bad reviews and what's shown on their websites. And we'll get to that topic in another episode, but you're right about that. I hate siding with them.
All right. Yeah, we'll cut it off there before they listen in and give us one-star reviews from these publicly recognized figures. Okay. Next question. This comes from Curious in Culver City. Where should I open up an LLC in another state for tax advantage if I'm residing and operating in California?
Everyone's always trying to avoid taxes. I don't know why. Maybe because it's very expensive in California. What is it? Franchise tax, you have to pay $800 per year on most entities,
right?
Whether you make $0 or $1 billion. So in California and some other states as well, people are always trying to figure out, okay, how do I avoid filing my entity in California? But here's the deal is if you're a California business, that's pretty much where you're going to have to register.
Yeah, it comes down to basically your actions in California. I mean, we can get into all the specific details, but if you have a bank account, it essentially comes down to if you're conducting business in California, then you're not really going to be able to get out of this having to pay the franchise tax, at least in the state.
Yeah, so there's not only a bank account, but what else? If you have an office there, if you have a mailing address there, if you have employees there, all these different items, it's a factor test. So not one thing is going to make the difference. But if you're on the cusp of back and forth, then you probably want to get an attorney to take a look. A lot of times too, if you're out of state and you want to do business in California, you may also have to register it as a foreign corporation or foreign LLC or other foreign entity, and then you'll end up paying for those franchise fee taxes and other state taxes as well. So that's something to think about. This question's asking, okay, I'm residing in California and operating in California, now how do I get out of that, opening in another state? It also works vice versa too, if you're residing outside the state but doing business in California.
You were right at the beginning. This is a question, at least I know I get a lot too. It's the one thing that someone always brings up. It's probably the second thing that comes up. One, what type of entity should I form? And two,
can I file in Nevada? Right.
I've heard Delaware's good, or I've heard Nevada's good.
Wyoming, yeah.
It's just something they've heard at one point, have no idea why. It's just an idea that gets in their head from somewhere or something. And usually we have to tell them why it's probably not going to work out that way.
Yeah, sometimes there are advantages of registering out of state, but that doesn't mean that you're going to avoid registering your foreign corporation or foreign entity in California as well. And that's where people, I think, get confused is, okay, they're a startup company, let's register in Delaware, which is fine. And there's some advantage of that. And there's some attractiveness to investors for that. But then you still possibly have to register your entity in California. And so you're not saving franchise taxes on that.
That's what I said. At the end of the day, we usually have to deliver that bad news to them.
Yeah, typical bad information going out there.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Let's take a little break here. And I hate to bring this up again. This is every episode now, but there was this, I don't know if you watch Jon Stewart. I'm more of a Colbert guy myself.
You would be.
But I watch Jon Stewart from time to time. Stewart went on this rant about Chicago style deep dish pizza. And it was all because the new tower that went up in New York City being technically taller than the, I still call it the Sears Tower. I forget the name of what it's called now in Chicago.
I think the Willis Tower.
Willis Tower, yeah. And it's all a dispute on which one's taller. I guess the one in New York now has this, Chicago's calling it an antenna. The official people that decide are calling it a fixture. So technically, the new tower in New York is taller. Anyways, Stewart goes on this rant about Chicago versus New York pizza. And it's pretty funny. You can go look on Comedy Central. I'm sure it's on there. But
we can post a link.
I just found this humorous after we devoted half of our episode last week to pizza. And he actually makes some good points, too. I, for one, am a New York style pizza person. But he essentially says Chicago style pizza isn't pizza. It's more of a casserole, and it's pretty funny. If you want, we should, we'll link it in the notes here, and you can go back and watch it. But I don't know if you saw that or not.
I did, but I got to stop you here. We've already decided that we're not going to have a pizza episode for a while, and I can't believe you're bringing this up again after, especially after the controversy of last week, that of the sauce versus crust thing, which I took a poll, by the way, and I won out by a lot. It was scientific and everything. And actually hired a Gallup poll to do that for us. So so let's move on without talking about it further.
Yeah.
Without any rebuttal. So our next article is, I kind of hate reading these articles every year because usually they come out around April 15th or a little before. And what I'm getting at is there's an article about the IRS and what they're targeting this year for audits, because obviously that's everyone's greatest fear. What are they targeting this time?
They're supposedly focusing more on small business partnerships. I've always wondered if they just put these stories out there to get people to actually comply more. I'm sure they're actually doing more audits on these, but it could be a scare tactic as well. But that's just a personal opinion. Anyways, they're really focusing on pass-through entities. So we're talking S-corps, sole props, businesses that don't pay their income taxes directly, and instead it passes through to the owners.
Let's call Brad Gastineau from his accounting firm. I think he'd have some good insight on this. What do you think?
Yeah, I think he'll offer something from his perspective, because I'm sure he sees this from a different light than you or I would.
Sure. Let me give him a call here. Let me see if I can work this out. Hey, Brad, this is Nasser Pasha. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Matt, you still there?
Yeah. How you doing, Brad?
Did we catch you sleeping or what's going on?
Me? Do I sound like it?
No, I was just joking.
Not sleeping.
Oh, very good. So, Brad, you're a bean counter. Is that what you're called again?
That's how we're affectionately known, yes. Bean counter.
A CPA. Okay. So we came across this article and we thought of you, and it's about a small business partnerships being a priority for IRS exams. And Matt and I were just talking about how it seems like every year they have a new thing that they're targeting, but at the same time, it seems like the same that they're targeting small businesses and so forth. So what are your thoughts on this?
It doesn't surprise me that they're going after partnerships. I mean, I think like all pass-through entities are probably looking at, because that's like the vast majority of all entity types out there are going to be pass-through entities. That would include S corporations as well. So, when you have the majority of the businesses that are in that type of a legal structure, it makes sense that they would be focusing their resources on auditing those type of businesses.
Okay, very cool. Brad, why don't you tell us a little about your company? I can't for the life of me pronounce the full name because it has about 5 or 6 different names in it, right?
Yeah, it's got 3 in the title, but there's at least one long one in there, but it's Gatto, Pope, and Walwick, and it's a local San Diego CPA firm. There's around 40 of us, and we really have a main focus on tax. tax planning and compliance for probably essentially the same type of businesses that the IRS is probably targeting, which is, you know, a lot of our clientele are pass-through entities. That type of entity structure can be super complex. There's lots of advantages to being, you know, a small business owner and a pass-through entity from a tax standpoint, and knowing how to navigate those rules is something that we focus on, and people look to us to help them make sure their filings are done properly and that all the tax planning has been done and the opportunities have been uncovered and taken advantage of. To be honest with you, with knowing that the IRS is looking at these type of entities, which we've seen in the audits that we've been going through that we periodically have, the pass-through entities can be so complex, especially when you think of like hedge funds and, you know, international, and so you have foreign reporting requirements and things like that. The IRS agents that I've come in contact with are usually a couple years out of school, and they don't really have the knowledge to even know what they're looking at. You know, they're looking at a checklist of things they're supposed to check off, but they don't understand the concepts, and so they think there's issues where there aren't issues.
Well, that's crazy. I would have thought that these auditors are sophisticated, but that's interesting that you're saying that, because as a business owner, that's the number one scare in paying taxes, is that I'm going to get audited. And most of the time, it's because people cut corners here and there if they're not using a legitimate accountant and so forth.
Hey, Brad, I was going to ask one thing. Obviously, other than talking to you, is there any advice you can give to these smaller businesses to kind of prepare them for this new scare tactic that the IRS has out?
Just knowing how complex these entities are, I definitely would suggest, and this isn't an advertisement for me, but I definitely suggest they get professional assistance in filing their partnership returns or S-Corp returns. We've acquired some new clients who have prepared their own partnership return in the past, and without having any knowledge as to, I'd say, income taxes even in general, they're preparing these complex partnership returns, and they're not doing a good job at it, and that could be very well the reason why they might get audited. Now, granted, you can't ever fully get rid of any risk of being audited, because the IRS obviously just randomly selects people as well, even if they don't have a red flag on their return.
So they say they randomly do it.
But if you have like competent preparer that's helping you through it, then if you do get audited, you don't have anything to worry about. It's still a pain. It costs you money. But if you can come out of an audit with no adjustments or very few adjustments, that's a pretty good day. But if they see that you prepared the return on your own and doesn't even balance or whatever, then they start digging and thinking, well, what else is this person not good at? Maybe they're not good at keeping receipts, which they're supposed to keep, or, you know. Then the adjustments can start adding on and penalties, and it just isn't worth it to go through one of those without some professional assistance. So on the front end, Matt, that would be my advice, is to, you know, hire somebody who knows what they're doing to help get at least the returns filed properly. But then more than that, just aside from filing the tax returns, that's just a compliance issue. You know, there's planning that can be done and steps that can be taken, you know, within the year or related to a significant transaction that could actually help save you taxes if you have competent advice and advisor on your team.
You could have just said, talk to you, and that would have been fine. Acceptable answer. But
I didn't want to sound like I was doing a commercial for me.
Next time we will. Well, I appreciate your time. Before you go, though, you mentioned pass-through entities. Can you explain really quick what entities that includes as well?
Yeah, essentially it's partnerships, which a partnership can be many different legal structures. It could be a limited partnership or a limited liability partnership or an LLC or a general partnership, but those all file the exact same tax return from a federal standpoint. So a partnership tax return is a pass-through entity. On top of that, there are S-corporations, which is a corporation that's elected to be treated as an S-corporation, which essentially has a lot of similarities to a partnership where the income passes through to the owners, and the individual or C-corporation owners are the ones that ultimately pay the tax on that income. So that's where that pass-through term comes from.
Well, very cool, Brad. Thank you for your time, and that's really helpful to our audience. You're from Gatto Pope in Walwick. Did I say it right?
Nailed it.
Oh, wow. It's my years of knowing you. That's what it is.
I appreciate you guys giving me a call.
Yeah, thanks, Brad.
Yep, take care.
All right, see you later. That was fun talking to Brad. That was our first guest interview.
Yeah, it was. Oh, I think he gave a good perspective. It's always good to get firsthand accounts of people that are in the trenches dealing with this on a day-to-day basis, it sounds like.
Is it just me, or was he able to... He sounded so official when it was answering the questions, in the sense that when we answer legal questions, we're a little bit more casual. I swear he's like an open book when it comes to that.
Yeah, you're dead on with that. I usually just say, look at the documents. That's pretty much my answer for 75% of the things. He gave very detailed answers.
It was very good. Well, we'll probably have him on again for all those technical accounting questions.
Yeah, definitely.
But I called him a bean counter. Think he was offended by that?
Well, if he was, he's got a twin brother, so we'll just bring his twin brother on next time.
That's true. Unless they're connected in such a way that when one is offended, the other is too.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to our next question.
Last question. I have a great idea for a new restaurant. The problem is it hinges on the staff wearing specific, possibly questionable outfits. How do I pull this off legally? From future restaurant owner in Los Angeles.
I like how he was very generic with the word questionable. It could mean a lot of different things when it comes to questionable.
Yeah, I don't think we're talking about just a different shirt that someone has to wear.
Or maybe it's an outfit that doesn't match, which is a little questionable.
Yeah, or have to put items of flair on, like an Office Space. I forget the name of that restaurant.
Yeah. Obviously, I think we're assuming here a Hooters-like restaurant, right?
That's what I would guess, yeah.
Do you partake in attending restaurants like Hooters?
I've been there before. I have a couple friends that really like it, but it's really some of my friends are big fans. I really could care less about the actual attire, but when you go to those places, they're usually pretty crowded, so they get a lot of people to show up, whether it be a Hooters or there's a similar one, another franchise, Tilted Kilt. There's actually a new spot here in San Diego called Lucky Bastard, so the name alone should cue you in on that one, but it's possibly even worse than Hooters and Tilted Kilt, and I'll just leave it at that. I would think that with the number of Hooters restaurants there are and the Tilted Kilt franchise as well, and I'm sure there's others, I know there are in Las Vegas, other places across the U.S., obviously, these companies have been able to get past any sort of, you know, employment discrimination issues that have arisen.
Yeah, so they get away with it through an exception in employment discrimination. It's called a bona fide occupational qualifications. And us lawyers put this into an acronym to make it easy for us. It's BFOQ. This rolls off your tongue. And what they do is, if there is a legitimate or a certain essence of the business operation that would be undermined if this business eliminated its discrimination policy, and there's some kind of entertainment value or something to that effect, then there's some built-in exceptions. And so this person's asking, okay, how do I pull this off legally? Well, we already know that in Hooters, for example, when they get hired, they're asked a certain number of questions to sign off on. For example, they acknowledge that their job entails some kind of sexual appeal, and the work environment is such that they'll be joking and entertaining with their customers. Even their outfit, for example, they have to acknowledge that their uniform is not offensive, it's not intimidating, hostile, or even unwelcome. And it's not a coincidence that these same words or verbiage is what's used in the discrimination law to determine whether you have a sexual harassment case or a hostile work environment.
Right. I would think, by the way this question was worded, I would guess it's the Hooters-like model of how they're having people dress. And you're right, you talk to the employees up front about it, they sign off on everything. But I would still think, even then, you're not going to be immune to getting sued later down the road for something based on the outfits that you make them wear.
That's true, because even today, even after all the litigation that's occurred, Hooters still get sued for various different things. I think just last year they were being sued because they were terminating employees that got too fat.
That's a problem.
Yeah, exactly. But so when you enter in that kind of venture, you're going to have to expect that you're going to get some pushback in certain industries. And, you know, this goes without saying, you're going to need an attorney to really outline it for you in detail.
Yeah, I think that's the best answer to this question is talk to an attorney, get it set up properly. But even then, it's going to be, you're going to have some issues you're going to have to deal with down the road, most likely. If you want to structure your restaurant like this, there's not much you can really do to get around it. People are still going to complain at some point, but if you make enough money, then I guess you don't care.
That's true. Money solves all problems. So, all right, what's our next article, our last one here?
We'll end here on this, and let me read the title of this article, because it's one of the most obvious things ever. Maybe not obvious, but the cause and effect. Execs watching porn, a leading cause of malware problems. So apparently, there's a lot of execs out there that are watching porn in the office. I'm looking for the exact numbers. 40% of security professionals found that a device used by a member of their company's senior leadership team has been infected by malware because of a pornographic website. That seems high. I don't know.
40%. And then the other 60% is what? Just people clicking on links, right?
Yeah.
This reminds me of another Office episode. I don't even know how to comment on this, but from our legal spin perspective, what do you think about, I mean, this should not be happening, obviously, and you should have policies against this, but notice that they put executives. It's almost implying that it's the leadership, not the employees that are doing this.
Right. I would think the obvious fix if employees were doing this is to just put some sort of filters on which websites they were able to go to, but you're not going to do that for your senior execs. They pretty much can do whatever they want at that point. So I don't know if there's really anything you could do and who's going to talk to them about this. It's just a really awkward conversation to even have. This actually reminds me, I won't give any specific details, but I had a friend who worked in a law firm and they were talking to the IT guy that worked there. And the IT guy said, "You wouldn't believe how much porn gets watched in this office." And I was like, "What?" It seems so crazy to me. It's so weird and
awkward.
Yes, yeah, it's really awkward. There's no conversation you can have about this with the people that are viewing this that isn't going to be awkward.
Yeah. I honestly don't even know how to comment on this. This is so ridiculous, but that this actually goes on.
Yeah.
So that's our show. What episode number are we on? Like 500 or?
It's either 500 or 5. One of the
two. One of those. Remember. We appreciate you sending in your questions still, and that's at ask@lelysoundsmartbusiness.com. And we'll put in some of the links that we talked about in our show notes as usual. Thank you for joining us.
Yep. Goodbye.
All right. See you next week.
This has been the Legally Sound Smart Business Show with your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub. The Legally Sound Smart Business Show is your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Legally Sound Smart Business is a podcast that is intended but not promised or guaranteed to be current, complete, or up to date, and should in no way be taken as an indication of future results. No attorney-client relationship is created by listening or submitting questions to the podcast. The podcast does not constitute legal advice, but rather is offered only for general informational and educational purposes. You should not act or rely on any information in the podcast without first seeking the advice of an attorney. The opinions expressed in the podcast reflect the views of those individuals and do not necessarily represent the views of any other individual or business. For more information about the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, visit LegallySoundSmartBusiness.com.